this little baby is a genuine Catholic baby. When David and I were in Rome one year, we discovered, we'd seen these babies in Italy, and when we were in Rome, we went to the Vatican, and you know, basically we asked around, where can you buy the baby Jesus? There's a whole street that's filled with these things, because there's, of course, all Catholic churches need them. So this one particularly seemed appropriate for us, and he's been our baby for a long, long time. Before we had this one, I had a midwife friend who gave us an exactly accurate midwife's model baby that they use for newborns to train siblings about having their babies, and we used to have that little one, and he had all the bald head and everything. He didn't quite have the spiritual consciousness of this one. But he was such a real baby. And when we first had him and we were first developing our Christmas services on Christmas Day, for those of you who can come or have come, we tell the whole story of the baby Jesus. And when we were first sort of developing that and trying to get the feeling of it, and I had gotten the midwife's doll, which was ours, and so on Christmas morning, I would get up and sort of practice telling the story to the baby Jesus, and just a little bit of relating to him. And pretty soon, all the sense of whether he's animate or inanimate begins to leave you, doesn't it? You know, even as I hold him now, I bought him. There were 100 of them in the store. But you could no more treat this as if he wasn't alive. One simply can't. You know, all children who have stuffies, all adults who have stuffies, you can say that that little stuffy is made of the same stuff as your jacket, but it feels really different than your jacket because something comes alive in it. Isn't that so? There's the whole story of the Velveteen Rabbit, which is all about how the little rabbit is loved into life by the child, and then it goes on. And I think all of us secretly suspect, don't we, that when the toy store is closed, that all those dolls get off the shelf and dance. You know, sometimes there's more truth in fantasy than there is in fact. Swami Kriyananda talks about his own education. He was trained in the classical myths, and he talks about what a shame it is that those don't form such a part of people's education. Because sometimes you have to say something that isn't factually true in order to waken a reality of a deeper truth that just is not always described by the facts. Saint Joseph of Cupertino was a very great saint. In fact, he was such a great saint that he became a great embarrassment to the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has a very dynamic understanding of the mystical side of spirituality, but they have this unfortunate thought that that mysticism is somehow bestowed by the church itself, and therefore all their priests should be equally endowed. So it's very difficult for them when one of their priests is manifestly more endowed than one of the others. It gives a lie to their whole system. So they tend to like to hide them if they possibly can. But God's light has a way of not staying put away. Well, St. Joseph of Cupertino was confined more or less in perpetual seclusion for many years in the small room in the basement of the big basilica of Assisi. And we visited there in the little room where he spent years and years in seclusion. Was that really a punishment? You don't know. But one of the things that was in that room was this tiny doll. I'm a little smaller than this one, which had been St. Joseph's chosen form of God. And he lived down there, not alone at all in his own mind, but he lived with the little baby Jesus. And that whole way of spiritual practice, although relatively speaking unknown in the West, is extremely common in the East. I'm going to put baby Jesus down for a moment because he gets a little heavy, actually. Even though I'm reluctant to, I'll put him back on the altar.
That's fine.
Yeah, it does. for which David is very grateful. I remember the first time I had a friend who had a baby, and I was helping her with her children, and we brought in the groceries and we brought in the baby. You know, you just put the groceries down on the counter, but the baby, you can't just put him down somewhere and just have him be okay, like a loaf of bread or something like that. You know? It was my first realization of what motherhood actually meant, which is probably why I never had children. Anyway, going on, when we talk on our opening prayer, which I know most of you know, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved, what we're describing are the classical bhavs, the classical inner relationships with the divine. And we don't, Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, whom we call Master, developed that poem for the West, and he left one out, which was God is the baby. You know, father, mother, friend, beloved, baby, baby, God. You know, it sort of doesn't work with the way we think. But in the Indian tradition, it's very, very common. Baby Gopal can be your Ishtadeva, which means your chosen form of God. And there's people who worship. We don't understand in the West what that means, worship baby Gopal. And Gopal and all the stories about him as a mischievous child form the body of their understanding and how they relate. Now, we do this once a year, without ever dignifying it with a bigger understanding, which is once a year our devotion is to Jesus as the baby. Now, if we start thinking about it, just my holding the little child here and all of the sort of sense that comes into us immediately, I mean, everybody immediately says, oh, isn't that cute? I mean, this is just a doll. Imagine if I were up here holding somebody's tiny little newborn baby. When we did our Christmas Eve creche for many years, we used to ask the woman, the family that had the youngest child would be the holy family. And so we'd have a mother and a father and a live baby up there at midnight. And as you can imagine, that was a mixed blessing. Some baby Jesuses were more Jesus-like, let's put it that way. Some of them, you know, were very noisy, and some were quiet. Some of them just plastered their face against the mother's breast, and they were nothing more than a lump the whole time. But of course, the presence of a tiny baby, the heart immediately softens, doesn't it? And there's not only all of this love coming out of us, of the simplest kind. Swamiji tells this story of when he was a young disciple with Master. And he had been a very intellectual person, and even a very proud, he writes himself, in his intellectuality and a little bit dismissive of many aspects of things. And there was one disciple of Master's, a direct disciple, and the man was afflicted with very severe cerebral palsy and couldn't move very well, and his speech was very much affected, so he certainly could never articulate any sophisticated ideas, and so it was somewhat unknown what kind of intelligence he actually had. And Master spoke of him as a very advanced soul who was very close to liberation because he had such devotion to God. And Swami Kriyananda, just applying the normal standards that he was accustomed to using, said to Master, "Well, sir, it must be a very simple kind of devotion." And Master, instead of saying, "Yes, yes, you know, but that's all right," Master, he said, got the most blissful expression on his face and said, "Yes," he said, "that's the kind that pleases Divine Mother the most." Now, it's a very important realization for us to come to realize that everything that is that the world considers to be so important, it doesn't necessarily translate that those are the most direct routes to God. Now, it's not that we need to stop being all of the competencies that God gives us, but it's a little bit like Sri Yukteswar said, speaking of intelligence, he said, a high intelligence is a two-edged sword. It can either bind us in ever more subtle delusion, or it can be used like a sword of discrimination to cut through delusion and see the truth behind everything. The reason this devotion for the baby Jesus is such a beautiful aspect of our spiritual life. And actually, it's very interesting. It was St. Francis of Assisi who really crystallized devotion in the way that we express it now. He was the first on Christmas Eve to make the creche scene. Now, how much devotion there was for Jesus as a baby before that time, I don't know. But Francis came at a time when, in truth, the whole edifice of the Catholic Church was extremely, and by therefore, by extension, the whole strength of devotion to Jesus was quite fragmented. And Francis's divine incarnation, the purpose of that incarnation, was to bolster a true understanding of what it was to love Christ. And of course, he was extremely radical in the way he went about that. He started his own monastic order based on a strict renunciation where, as long as he had the power to influence it, they had no buildings, they had no libraries, they had no fixed assets, they had no land. Eventually, others took over and they felt they had to be more practical. And they brought it more into the form in which you see it today. But during Francis's time, in fact, when Francis returned from a long pilgrimage to the Holy Land and found that they'd built an actual monastery instead of just living out in huts in the woods, he climbed on the roof and with his own hands he tried to rip the roof tiles off. And then after that, he realized that the power of it had passed out of his hands. And he simply retired from trying to influence the organization and let it take its own course. But what he was there to re-inspire was this extremely profound, simple, uncompromising understanding of what true Christianity is. Forget all the learned treatise, forget all the study, forget the pomp and circumstance of the church, forget all the politics and the power, just back to the simple devotion and imitating the life of Christ, living nowhere, you know, give no heed for the morrow, as the Lord, look how beautifully God dresses the lilies of the field, the swallows of the air, do you think he won't take care of you also? Francis took all of that literally and had the spiritual power not only to live it himself, but also to inspire others. And in keeping with that, one Christmas Eve, he arranged a surprise, not only for his monks, but I believe for the whole town of Assisi. And he had arranged this creche scene and the birth of the baby Jesus at midnight. And that's where the tradition began, where at midnight we have the birth of the baby and we all celebrate it. Now, the reason why he did this, because certainly St. Francis had the most sophisticated intelligence that you could imagine. He was raised in a refined household. He was the son of the wealthiest man in town. It wasn't that he himself didn't have the capacity to understand on any level he wanted to, but he knew what would really move us closer to the divine. And this is the great challenge that we all live in our lives, is that there is this tremendous force. In India, they call it Maya. They call it the great illusion that all of our senses are turned outward and our thoughts are that we're born into this world and as soon as we start, even as little babies, we start relating outwardly to all these things and we try to grow up and we try to learn things and we try to acquire things and we try to relate. And it doesn't have to be an exclusive one or the other, but there's this strong inclination by this power of Maya, this bewitching force. In the West, we call it Satan, which is a little bit of a harsher word. But nonetheless, however you describe it, there seems to be this conscious force that always wants to pull our mind outward and always define our reality in terms of what's going on around us. Of course, just a little bit of life experience. And we begin to discover that, yes, you know, a comfortable home, a lovely family, a highly developed intelligence and education, success. Nobody's talking about either or. All of those things are, well, among other things at the very least, they're the way we train our consciousness. People who refuse to apply their willpower and discipline themselves toward accomplishment do not, as a rule, end up being more inspiring than those who do. But the fact of the matter is, if all we have is the form of things, and in the process of doing it, we have failed to open our hearts, to cultivate that simple sweetness, where do we end up at the end? Well, you see the examples in our own lives and all around us, don't we? People who, no matter what they have done, it all somehow, instead of the eyes becoming brighter and brighter and the face becoming more and more beatific, people get wizened in a very, not such a nice way. One of my friends, speaking of her mother, quoting her mother, she said when her mother died at the end of her life, when she was literally on her deathbed, in a peculiar way she demonstrated her own wisdom. She said to her daughter, "I always thought when I would get older, I would get wiser, but I didn't." Just like that. But almost in that childlike humility, my friend said, there was something so true about her understanding. She always thought she'd get important somehow. And she realized somehow that she was always just this little child and died with that childlike sweetness. You see, the great problem is the more we absorb of all the things that cause the world to think we're important, the more we begin to mistake that for real wisdom and real happiness. And it's not like there's anything wrong with it. It's just that if we fail to develop the goodness of the inner self, then we never end up where we really want to be. So it brings us back to the little baby Jesus. And we can see that in that relationship to the child, this is why it's a classical bhav, in that relationship to the child, effortlessly, all of the qualities that we work so hard to develop begin to come out of us, don't they? I recall once when I was trying to help what turned out to be, I'm sad to say, a doomed marriage. The woman had lost respect for her husband. She was raising children, male children as it was, and she was a very good mother, but she'd lost respect for her husband, and she made no secret of her disdain for him. And I dealt with both of them for a while for the sake of the children. But finally, when I really began to see what was going on, and I rarely say this, I said to him, "You must get away from that woman. You know, no matter what the cost, she's not good for you." And then I spoke to her and I said, "Would you ever relate to your sons the way you relate to your husband?" And she said, "Well, no, of course not." I said, "Why?" Well, and she gave me all the obvious reasons, because it wouldn't help them, because she was responsible for nurturing their development and so on. I said, "Why is your relationship to your husband different than that?" Now, of course, all these karmic forces play into this, and I mean, you all know me well. My faults are well known to all of you. We don't always live up to what we want to live up to. But you see, mother love immediately brings out of us this thought that I'm here to serve. That in the tender dependency of this little child, we almost spontaneously put aside, we simply cannot indulge our own desire for this or for that. I want to have this thing. I need to be recognized like that. Why don't you pay attention to me? You're not listening. Why aren't you acknowledging? What about how I feel? And in the right time and place, it's not inappropriate to stand up for yourself. We have to relate to every reality in an appropriate way at the appropriate time. But the great bane, the great cause of really of all suffering, we say this in the Festival of Life, whereas joy is the fruit of love for God, pain is the fruit of self-love. And we don't mean self-esteem, self-acceptance. I mean, I'm not going to try to qualify it too far. But self-love, loving self over others, or putting it differently, defining yourself as different than others. Now, the whole reality of this is that behind everything dwells the presence of God. That's what was being read today. We want to come to the point where we break Maya's spell, where Satan whispering in our ear, oh, your happiness lies in thinking more about yourself than others. That person over there, really, he's not important compared to you. After all, you're talented. You have all this potential, you know, and this is just so-and-so. And after all, I need to stand up for myself, too. And what about my needs? What about me? That question, in that little children's story, Charlotte's Web, one of the characters always says that question, what's in it for me, Charlotte? What's in it for me? And that sort of masks as wisdom, doesn't it? You hear that voice, what's in it for me? Well, we can either reinforce our sense of separateness from this world. We can consistently act in such a way as to buttress the needs of the ego. And we all do that quite spontaneously and naturally. Or we can act in such a way is to strengthen the consciousness of the divine within us. And we think that there's a limit to how much we can do that without, you know, crossing the bounds of what's sensible. No, actually, there is no limit. And that's what the great masters come to show us. Paramahansa Yogananda said in a tape we were listening to during our meditation yesterday. He said so simply, there is no Yogananda anymore. In another place, he said it, I killed Yogananda long ago. He said, no one dwells in this temple now but God. Now, what we have to understand, and this is the dynamic truth presented even by this baby Jesus, Swamiji writes later when we come closer to Easter, about this incredible contradiction, because even though we're sort of playing with the little baby here, we all know, because this story is so ancient, that this story, this little baby, grows up to be this force of immense power that actually offers himself as a sacrifice on the altar of being crucified and gives up his very life for the salvation of all of us and faces this pain and humiliation and this horrible death. You know, and then there's a little baby. It's a tremendous contradiction on a certain level, and the rational mind can't put it all together. But what's being shown to us is the greatest power in the universe, is that power which has transcended the limitation of self and can embrace infinity. That was the power that Master and Christ and all of these great masters have brought us. Jesus himself, even though in the end he allowed himself to be crucified, was a fierce and powerful fighter through his whole life, and only when he said, even as he was being crucified, even now my Father would bring down legions of angels to rescue me. And the only reason you have power over me is because I've allowed my Father to give you power over me. There was no weakness there. You see, the strongest among us, if you really pay attention to it, are the examples of the saints. I mean, they're the ones who can stand up for truth no matter what the personal cost. Even Jesus, toward the end of his life, when he knew that his crucifixion was coming, he said to one of his disciples, greater can no love be than this, that a man is willingly lays down his life for his friends. Isn't that a simple statement? Now you see, isn't that what mother love is, and father love for that matter? I remember my friend, after his two sons were born, he said to me, he said, before my children were born, he said, I thought I was a pretty unselfish guy. He said, I thought I was, but I realized that to be unselfish means to have no self. He said, now that I've had to raise these two sons, all sense of me has just gone completely away. There's many traditional myths, you know, in which the child is born and it eats the parents. Have you seen those pictures? Because, well, gee, I never raised children in this life, but I know they just eat the parents. Because that's what it takes. But does the parent who does that, out of pure self-giving, feel diminished from that experience? You see? And at what point does that capacity to give to others stop? No greater love can be than this, than a man be willing to lay down his life for his friends. Isn't that an extraordinary image? Whether we're literally talking about physical life, or just having always the consciousness that I am here to serve. In the first principle of the Ananda Sanghis, Swami talks about the underlying all-pervasive reality of Satchidananda, God behind everything, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss, binds us all together in a bond of mutual service. Isn't that just exquisite? It takes it all out of dogma and religion and Jewish and Christian and all of that. This underlying all-pervasive reality of which we are a part binds us in a bond of mutual service for the very simple reason that we are one. And more than that, because that's where bliss comes from. It comes from transcending all of this, going into that. And so we have the baby Jesus because it's no effort. And when we catch that moment, oh, this is not difficult. This is the greatest joy. Then once we taste it from that side, because we never do anything unless we think it's going to make us happy. So we have to have these moments in which we touch in, and the bliss is so natural that all this carefully constructed resistance to that simple devotion, which is so pleasing to Divine Mother, just dissolves in the experience of the bliss itself. This is what Christmas is about. Just joy, 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 joy. Bless.